Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com. And by Douglas J., with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okemos Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for graduation and Father's Day. DouglasJ.com.
It's Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are looking at a fairly busy Friday here heading into Father's Day weekend. We officially learn Congressman Mike Rogers' plans today regarding a possible Senate run. And I confess I'd love to be at the meeting today between Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr and dozens of creditors of the City of Detroit. Mr. Orr is expected to propose some serious haircuts today. We will await response from those creditors. Their response will presumably play a very critical role in whether the city can avoid filing for bankruptcy. Coming up this hour, Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon on the, it's his annual State of the Franchise address here on WKAR. We also learn about the Ann Arbor Summer Festival and a segment for dads on Father's Day. Yesterday, in a unanimous ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that naturally occurring genes cannot be patented. The ruling will affect researchers, universities, and industry. Jennifer Carter Johnson's an assistant professor of law at Michigan State University. She also holds a Ph.D. in microbiology, and using her background in law and in biology, she provides some insight for us on the Supreme Court's ruling. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Let's start at the very beginning and revisit what it means for a company to have a patent on something. What does having a patent empower a company to do?
Well, a company that has a patent on an invention has the right to exclude everybody else in the country from practicing that invention. In effect, they have a monopoly on practicing, in this case, a gene patent, a gene.
And if somebody invents a tool, for example, a new screwdriver that goes on sale at Sears, and Sears doesn't hold the patent holder at least gets some kind of royalty? Does it work like that?
They would, yes. So in that sort of case, Sears would either have to license the right to make the screwdriver from the patent holder.
Gotcha.
Or they would get it sold by the patent holder to them and then sell it on.
Well, this gets very 21st century here with the Supreme Court's ruling. A little more background. When was it determined that genes were patentable?
Well, so that's actually the interesting thing. It's been assumed that genes were patentable since about the 1980s when the Supreme Court had, in a case called Diamond versus Chakrabarty, said anything under the sun created by man, which opened the door to patenting living things generally. And people assumed then that genes were patentable, but it's never been tested until this Supreme Court case.
It took 30 years for that to come around.
It did.
Give us some background on this dispute that was settled yesterday, the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad Genetics. How did this whole thing come to a head?
So this is another case that has been a long time in the making. The patent at issue is for the BRCA1 and 2 genes that are implicated, mutations in which are implicated in breast and ovarian cancer. So if you have these, mutations in these genes, you're 80% likely, there's an 80% likelihood that you will have developed breast cancer or ovarian cancer. And so women have been looking for screening methods so that they can assess their risk and determine the pathway that they want to take. Myriad Genetic, holding the patents to the genes and the diagnostic tests, have been the sole provider of the diagnostics because no one else could, because of this monopoly, patent monopoly, be able to provide the test. And because of that, they've been charging very high prices. A lot of researchers across the country have wanted to get into this process of doing these tests for women, and they've been excluded from doing that.
I see. And it, the heart of the ruling, now the BRCA is a naturally occurring human gene then?
It is,
and that was at the heart of the ruling, as I understand it. Since it was naturally occurring, then they had no right to patent that.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, and what was the case? How did the Association for Molecular Pathology defend it? Was it just on the grounds of precedent that it had always been okay to do this?
In part, they said that there was a lot of reliance by the biotech industry because the biotechnology industry has grown up on these gene patents.
Right.
But they've also made the argument that by taking the gene out of its natural context in the human cell, the isolation step itself, was enough human input to make it now not just naturally occurring, but also man-made.
We're talking with Jennifer Carter-Johnson, who's an assistant professor of law here at Michigan State University, about the impacts of the Supreme Court ruling yesterday on whether genes are patentable or not. Now, how does this ruling impact the availability of the testing that women might, will that free up, will it make it a lot easier for women to be tested for this, for the BRCA, have their BRCA genes analyzed?
It should. It looks like it will at this point. There are already laboratories out there that are indicating that as soon as the Supreme Court case came down, that they would be looking to offer this test. So it looks like it'll be both easier to find, there'll be more companies out there, which should bring the price down.
And there's no higher court to appeal to.
No.
So this would seem to settle the matter once and for all. I know your background's in law and biology, not Supreme Court watching, but does the unanimous decision mean anything that you know of?
I think
9-0.
You know, we talk a lot about these split decisions and the court being very polarized, but in honesty, a lot of decisions are come down in
really?
A unanimous manner. They just happen to be decisions that, for the most part,
don't get a lot of
press
publicity.
Attention. This is one that does. But I think it's a strong message from the Supreme Court to the lower courts to say, don't push too far with patents because there is a public interest.
How do you see this case shaping just larger scientific research in the future?
I think it's going to have a lot of different impacts at a lot of different levels. At a basic research level, it's going to free up the ability of researchers across the board now to do research on these genes. Because they're not going to be
monopolized yeah.
by individual companies. At the same time, the biotech industry is going to have to reorganize a little bit. I don't think it's going to be catastrophic for them. One thing to point out is this case does not say that the application of these genes are unpatentable. Those are still patentable. Synthetically made DNA is still patentable.
Because it's
man-made.
Gotcha.
So the case is not biotech is not patentable. The case is actually fairly narrow. The genes as they exist in the chromosomes in our body, if you just purify those, not patentable. That leaves a lot of room for the tech industry to keep innovating.
You can only wonder where we're headed with this. You know,
the future is bright.
Okay. Will this at all change the role that universities play in research? You're suggesting then that this could be a catalyst for more research.
I think so. And I think the universities, especially government grant driven universities, we're in an era where government grants, federal funding of scientific research is much debated, and this is actually a great opportunity for those types of research projects now to go forward without having to worry about companies coming in and trying to sue researchers mm-hmm. for patent infringement. So I think it relieves a lot of pressure, outside pressure, as far as that goes. But I think it makes more important these basic research.
Tell us
programs.
A little bit about what's called cDNA. What is cDNA, and how is that impacted by this decision?
So cDNA is one of those forms of synthetic DNA that I mentioned before.
Okay.
that has not been deemed unpatentable.
Gotcha.
cDNA is complementary DNA, and very basically, if you look at the DNA sequence as it exists in your body, it's got a lot of junk in it. And so in order for the DNA to do its job, the body actually takes out extraneous bits of information and makes it one concise piece. And so through use of cellular machinery as well as laboratory machinery, scientists are able to make this complementary DNA, which looks a lot like our cellular DNA, but it's much more concise, and it just has the important bits in it.
Okay. And it's those, again, those cDNA, anything that falls under the category of cDNA would remain patentable.
Remains patentable.
By the decision as of yesterday.
Yes.
I'm curious, do you happen to know Angelina Jolie, the actress's double mastectomy recently, apparently came after testing like this. Was it the BRCA1 and 2 genes that she had analyzed?
I believe
it
was.
To determine that? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, do you see, tell me how somebody gets involved in biology and the law. That is fascinating to me.
I spent a good number of years as a research scientist at the University of Virginia, where I got my PhD, and I love science. But when it came time to thinking about a career, I was much more interested in the impact of science on society than I was spending my life looking at one protein, at one cell, at one stage of development. There are a lot of people that do it, and there's a lot of value to it, but I was much more interested in the broader picture.
I'm real curious. What do you make of the emphasis today on STEM education, science, technology, engineering, math, as somebody who is a scientist?
I think it is one of the single most important things that we can be doing in the U.S. today. Our future is going to be based on what we can do in those areas.
Okay. Jennifer Carter Johnson is an assistant professor of law at Michigan State University. She holds a PhD in microbiology. Jennifer Carter Johnson, thanks for helping us understand the Supreme Court ruling.
Thank you for having me.
The Ann Arbor Summer Festival bills itself as an international arts gathering. Events are indoors and outdoors over the next 3 weeks, and there's something for everybody. Kids, music lovers, film buffs, even public radio fans. Current State Scott Pohl has a preview of the 30th Ann Arbor Summer Festival. He spoke with Rob Wolf, now in his ninth season as the festival's executive and artistic director, starting with how they're getting things started today.
Things kick off 5 o'clock, and we have about 4 or 5 different bands playing that evening, a bunch of family activities for the kids, all kinds of fun stuff going on. And that's the beginning of the festival, which basically runs through July 7th, every night except Monday night. And throughout the run of the festival, there's probably about 150 different events happening on different stages throughout the festival.
One thing I wanted to make sure you and I talked about is Polyglots Tangle. What is it? When is it? This seems like a lot of fun to me.
It's going to be a lot of fun. A big, huge, messy installation that is coming over from Melbourne, Australia. And the company's called Polyglot. And it's a family, an outdoor family exhibition where kids actually create this huge, messy, elastic installation. They're given a ball of elastic, and they're allowed to go in and basically wrap different poles and the space within the exhibit. And over the period of 5 days, this kind of takes on a life of its own, and it keeps growing and growing. And so by the end of the 5 days, you have this sort of massive, elastic, almost spider web attraction that kids get to play in. And it's definitely visual art, but it's kind of dance party, sort of mixed part dance party, because, you know, they're playing some music as the kids are putting this together. And then, as I said, they're sort of just diving in and playing and bouncing against all of this elastic that is being created. Each day, about 500 kids will be in it creating. It's just amazing to see what it looks like, you know, after a couple days. It's all about sort of kids' creativity and sort of just letting them, their imaginations run wild. So we're very excited to be one of the few festivals in the States presenting this. I had the pleasure of seeing it last summer at Lincoln Center, and it just took over the plaza at Lincoln Center in New York. And so we're very, very excited to see it here in Ann Arbor.
There's another outdoor installation called Wild Bites Superhero for a few days starting on June 28th. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a great project, a digital art exhibition that is called Superhero, and it involves 3D projection mapping. And sort of the gist of it is images are projected. It'll be on the Burton Memorial Tower, which is a iconic structure here in Ann Arbor. Their image is projected onto the facade of the tower, and basically they animate that image, so it almost becomes like they are a superhero. So they're able to fly, and their bodies shrink and grow, and sort of flying in and out of the windows of the tower. So it's really going to be a great fun. It runs June 28, 29, and 30, from about 10 o'clock at night once it's dark, up to midnight. And it's a free attraction, so I hope folks come out and experience that.
Rob, I wanted to also bring up a program that's one of the indoors events that public radio listeners might want to take note of, and that is the public radio program Snap Judgment is going to do a live program in Ann Arbor on June 29th at the Power Center.
Absolutely. We're really excited. Glenn Washington, who's an alum of the University of Michigan, is coming with his show, Snap Judgment, and it's a storytelling show with music, and this will be one of their first engagements sort of on tour with this production. So we're very, very excited to host Glenn. As you said, that'll be Saturday the 29th at the Power Center for the Performing Arts right in downtown. And then a little bit later in the season, we have another public radio favorite with Ira Glass, and he has put together this funny new show called One Radio Host, Two Dancers. And it's, believe it or not, it's Ira Glass dancing and telling stories with the Monica Bill Barnes Dance Company. And it's a great little project that sort of tested itself out at Carnegie Hall last winter. And people just had such a great time with it that Ira decided to, you know, sort of take that on the road to some select events and festivals. So we're thrilled to have Ira on this season as well, and that will be at the Power Center as well on Saturday, July 6th.
Ira has no shortage of courage when he does these things, I must say.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's great fun to listen to him talk about the project, and, you know, if nothing else, just to come out and see him, you know, to dance, you know, is well worth the ticket price. But it's kind of a great way for us to close our season here at the Ann Arbor Summer Festival, so should be good fun.
There's also dance as part of the festival. Tell me about the dance programming.
Yeah, well, you know, we do a little bit of everything. You know, that's the beauty of a summer festival, is we have some music, dance, comedy, family activities, outdoor spectacles, some of the things we've already talked about. But this year we're hosting two dance projects. We talked a little bit about the Ira Glass dance project, and then we're also hosting the Trox, La Belle Trocadero de Monte Carlo, which is the famous all-male ballet company that performs classic dance pieces in drag And they've been around since I think the late 70s. But it's great fun to always host them. I think they haven't been to Ann Arbor in a number of years. So we'll be having them on July 5th at the Power Center. And you know, as I said, somewhat the beauty of a festival is sort of a hodgepodge of different art forms. And with our festival, we have a number of indoor shows and as well a number of outdoor shows going on. So all of it sort of happens simultaneously. And I think, you know, for the regular festival goer, they find a few things inside, they find a few things outside, and they sort of make up their experience from there.
Tell me about some of the other stuff going on.
We have some other great concerts on the season. A fantastic world music group called Amadou and Miriam from Mali, Pink Martini, Preservation Hall Jazz Band with the New Orleans Bingo Show. We mentioned Snap Judgment already. You know, a little bit of something for everybody on there. Some of those shows have tickets, you know, $15, $20. So I think it's a very accessible price point. And again, if you don't have that, there's all kinds of wonderful things to do at the free outdoor site. You know, the outdoor installations we talked about, you know, concerts on the different stages, family activities, that kind of thing. And one of the favorite parts of the Ann Arbor Summer Festival is our outdoor cinema series. And so on weeknights at 10 o'clock, we screen different movies on the inflatable screen on Ingalls Mall. And that's always an eclectic mix as well. So we have, you know, Hitchcock's Vertigo and Tom Hanks in Big and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And we sort of mix that in with some more recent titles and some commercial blockbusters. But, you know, I think that's a... Nothing defines summer quite like laying under the stars on a blanket and, you know, seeing a classic piece of cinema. So that should be great fun, too.
Season 30, one of those great round numbers. Can you give me a little background on the history of the Ann Arbor Summer Festival?
Oh, you bet. This event, our first festival was in 1984, and it's really a unique model. It's a town and gown event. That was really founded by the University of Michigan as well as the city of Ann Arbor, because in that time period, there really wasn't much going on in Ann Arbor in the summer months. Obviously, school was out, and the venues, Power Center, Hill Auditorium, Mendelssohn, they really weren't being used. And so a group got together, founded by Eugene Power, and decided to launch this festival. And it started off very much as a classical festival, somewhat modeled on the Stratford Festival or Spoleto. But through the years, the programming has changed. It's become much more popular, has a much wider appeal. But I still think that the idea of an arts festival, a celebration of community, you know, all of that very much holds true today as it did 30 years ago. And we just keep trying new programs and building things out. In the past couple of years, we've launched a mind-body wellness series. So you have yoga on the lawn and capoeira, and there's beer tastings and wine tastings and, you know, all kinds of fun social activities. Because I think, you know, again, the beauty of a festival is not only watching the artist, but I think it's the socializing part of it as well. So we're very excited to have made it to 30 years, and we're looking forward to a great season.
Sounds like lots of fun. The Ann Arbor Summer Festival runs through July 7th, and all the information you need can be found at A2, that's the number 2, A2SF.org. Rob Wolf is Executive Director of the Ann Arbor Summer Festival. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Scott, thanks for having me on, and hope everybody comes down to Ann Arbor.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up in our second half hour, Current State contributor Maureen Aboud remembers her father for Father's Day and the unique way her family coped with their loss. And to Mackinac Island for fudge that's coming up on Current State. Stay with us. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Lansing Lugnuts, the capital city's minor league baseball team, are into their 18th season playing at Michigan and Cedar and around the Midwest League. as the end of the first half of the regular season approaches this Sunday. The Lugnuts are under 500, 31-35 so far in the division, but our next guest assures me that the second half really matters too. Here to update the fortunes of Lansing's professional baseball franchise and to look at what lay ahead is owner, Lugnuts owner Tom Dixon. Nice to see you.
Morning, Mark.
So in single A, the first half of the season is one event, and the second half of the season is another event. How does that work?
Well, I think probably the genesis of it is to keep people interested in teams that aren't very good.
Okay.
So
it's a forgiving way to...
Forgiving league. So if you have a bad first half, and frankly, it makes sense in minor league baseball because these kids develop tremendously during the season.
Right.
In fact, our team is very young, and they're okay in the first half, but there's a lot of 18-year-old kids on the team, and chances are we'll actually be pretty good in the second half. So that's why they do it. They split the seasons, and even if you do poorly in the first half, you got a chance of getting in the playoffs if you do well in the second half.
The Lugnuts just launched its 18th season with you as the owner. Looking back on this Lansing chapter, what's it been like? Has it been worth it?
Well, my hair's gone gray. I look back at the pictures on when Sherry and I actually started this thing in 96. It's been great. I mean, that's a loaded question. I could talk for hours about the experience, but
you've stuck it out. You've been here 18 years. That says something.
That says something right off the bat. And I think there's a lot of people that thought we wouldn't, but it's been a great experience. And frankly, it's been pretty much what we hoped for.
As a team owner, Tom, what are some of the top vital signs, the metrics that you pay closest attention to, say on a weekly basis at least? I imagine attendance is way, way, way up.
Attendance,
yeah,
because
okay.
it drives everything. You know, obviously, if you're getting people to come to the ballpark, then you're selling them tickets, you're selling them hot dogs, you're selling them a beer, and that attracts sponsors who are interested in having successful franchises with people there. So it's really all about getting people to come to the ballpark.
What's just below that, though? Is it the fan experience? Is it salaries? Is it overhead, light bills? What is it?
Well, you know, even though it seems like it's a sport, at the end of the day, it's a business, just like any other business. So, you know, you look at revenue on one side and you look at expenses on the other side. Our biggest expense is our salaries, obviously, our people. Below that are... You know, the ballpark itself, we lease the ballpark from the city, and that's a big expense, and we have a lot of expenses in maintaining the ballpark. So, you know, we look at both sides of it. The revenue is primarily driven by ticket sales is number one. Then you've got food sales number two, and you've got sponsorship sales, and you got retail sales. We sell a lot of Lugnuts merchandise over there.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the four drivers from a revenue side. And then from an expense side, as I say, it's predominantly salaries, health insurance, it's all the things that any other business person has to deal with.
How much variation is there among the salaries?
Across,
it's another planet from the major leagues, I presume.
Are you talking player salaries?
From your highest paid player to your lowest paid player.
Is there
a lot of territory there?
Well, the interesting thing in affiliated minor league baseball, which is obviously we're affiliated with the major league, so I refer to affiliated major league baseball as different from independent baseball.
Okay.
We don't pay the player salaries. The player salaries are paid for by the major league team. So the Toronto Blue Jays, in our case, actually are paying the salaries of the players who play here.
Okay.
We pay them a percent of ticket revenue to compensate them for that. But the actual salaries, the players are drafted and paid for by the major league team.
But do they run? Is there a lot of territory between your highest paid player and your lowest?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there is.
Oh, yeah. Significant. It's kind of interesting. The actual monthly salaries of minor league baseball players are fixed at the different levels. So the base salaries are not different. They're the same. But there are huge signing bonuses for some of these guys.
No kidding.
Oh, huge. I mean, if you're a top round draft pick in minor league baseball, now you could make anywhere from $5 to $10 million signing bonus.
My gosh.
As an 18-year-old.
Okay. Yeah. Graham Couch of the Lansing State Journal recently described your business as unforgiving. Is he right?
I mean, it's a business you got to stay on top of. I mean, it is a little bit. You got to keep the, you know, our primary objective is to keep the experience of coming to the games just fabulous for people. You know, you've got to have a, you got to have a nice ballpark. It's got to be clean. The entertainment's got to be good. The food prices have got to be fair. The food's got to be good. I don't know if I would call it unforgiving, but you know, like any customer related business, you got to keep the experience, you know, really, really top notch to keep people coming back.
And also in Graham's LSJ article, he presented it as if it's a great deal more competitive in 2013 than it was when you bought the franchise in 1996. Is it just a lot more sophisticated, you think, in 18 years?
Well, the industry has become much more sophisticated. You know, it used to be you could buy these teams for, way less than you can today. they've become much more expensive, for one thing, and that has attracted probably a more sophisticated ownership group. The ballparks are way more sophisticated than they used to be. The ownership groups are more sophisticated. There's probably more competition for people's dollars. So yeah, in many ways, it has gotten more sophisticated.
Let's talk about the ticket buyer's experience at Cooley Law School Stadium. I'm led to believe that always needs to be evolving. Is that what you're looking at in the off season? Is just ways to tweak that and make it more appealing to put down the money for a Lugnuts ticket?
Yes. We're constantly looking at ways to make the experience better.
How has it changed?
Well, it starts with the facility. It's probably, when I come to town, the thing I'm watching the most is what's going on with the facility over there. Is it starting to show signs of age? Are some of our venues getting tired? Do they need to be renovated? Does the ballpark need an infusion of capital? The physical plant is very important.
Mm-hmm.
You've just got to maintain it, and the experience that goes along with it. If you're bringing 1,000 employees out for a picnic in right field, that picnic venue has got to look great because we're competing with 100 other places that people
options.
Could go.
Yeah.
Right. So the facility itself is number one, and then number two is just the show that we put on. From the minute people, what we like to say, from the minute people park their car to the minute they leave, what's the experience? Are they greeted pleasantly when they walk up to buy a ticket? Are they greeted pleasantly when they walk in the door? Does a ticket taker come up and say, "Can I help you find your seat?"
Mm-hmm.
When they go up to buy a beer or a hot dog, are they getting a good product? And it just goes on and on. As they're sitting watching the game, we can't control the game itself, but we can control everything around the game, the music, what's happening between innings, how people are treated. So all of that is very, very important too.
Not unlike a ton of other businesses, really.
Not at all.
Not who serve the public.
Not at all. There's a lot of things you could do with your money. You go to a movie, you go to a Michigan State game, you could go to the lake, you could stay home and watch a movie on TV. We've got to make the experience of coming to a game something that motivates people to want to come out and do it.
Were you hit by the recession hard? I mean, were those did the recession manifest itself in lower ticket sales for Lugnuts games?
A little bit. Yeah, we felt it. And as you know better than anybody, Michigan went into this recession probably a little bit earlier than the rest of the country. We started feeling it before people were feeling it nationally.
The lost decade.
And
yeah,
it was. Fortunately, it didn't hit us as hard as I think some folks, because our ticket prices are relatively inexpensive, and in some cases we were a low cost option for people who maybe didn't want to take a trip or couldn't afford to take a vacation that summer. They can stay in town and go to a Lugnuts game. So we felt a little bit at suite level, for example, where we rely on bigger companies to bring folks out and entertain. Those companies were feeling it, and therefore they cut back on their spending. We felt it a little bit there, but we've seen a big rebound in that area in particular. So we're feeling pretty good about how things are headed now.
You and your spouse, Sherry Myers, own a team in Alabama.
Yes.
You own, it's the two?
Yes, correct.
Okay, it's the two. How are the operations similar? How are they different?
Well, the most interesting difference between the two are just the two communities.
Oh, without a doubt.
The difference between Michigan and Montgomery, Alabama.
I thought you would say that first, to tell you the truth. Yeah.
It's just amazing, living in one country and doing business in two markets that are that that vastly difference has really been an interesting experience. People are people, but cultures are very different and politics are very different and so forth. So the thing that we had to get used to more than anything is just doing business in a different city, in a different region. But beyond that, you know, it's the same business.
Yeah.
We built a new ballpark there. It's newer. We built that ballpark in 2004. It's a beautiful place. It was built into an old train station. So we kept the guts of the train station and built this new ballpark around it.
How about
so
that?
It's absolutely a stunning facility and also doing quite well.
This has been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us. Tom Dixon is the owner of the Lansing Lugnuts. Go Nuts.
Thanks for having me on.
Thirteen years ago, right around Father's Day, Lansing native Maureen Aboud's father, prominent local attorney Camille Aboud, passed away from cancer. Maureen, who pens a popular blog about Lebanese food and culture called Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, was gracious enough to share her memories of her father and explain how the healing power of food helped her and her family cope with their loss.
The Lebanese cook their grief. Illness and death call us to our kitchens, to our lists on the fridge, to our huge pots and pans that we can lean on, sighing, stirring, clicking our tongues over the need to make this food now, so heartbreakingly rich and warm. It's our way of saying, we will not go without a proper send-off, without this day spent in the kitchen, kneading the sadness into the dough, boiling the sorrow into the milk, and preparing a full stomach for the journey. For weeks after my father was diagnosed with terminal illness, family, friends, and neighbors crossed our threshold bearing gifts of food. There was so much food that we rented a refrigerator for our garage. Every shelf bulged with containers. The showstopper in this procession was the largest ham I have ever seen. Uncle Fred baked the 28-pound hunk of ham in his own huge oven. For every major family event, from nuptials to burials, large cuts of meats are a typical Aboud response. The bigger the emotion, the more enormous the cut of meat. "You go to Goodrich's," my Uncle Fred began, looking my sister Peggy right in the eye. "Goodrich will get you whatever cut of meat you want, and it will be the best." Uncle Fred hoisted the ham onto our kitchen table with the look of accomplishment behind his tears. My father's illness and death had brought about a kind of reconciliation among his brothers, who for years had a mercurial relationship. They had inherited their mother's passionate temperament, one that refused to be stifled in anger or in love. The brothers' success in their family law firm was the happy backdrop to the drama of their disputes, ending in an explosive dissolution of their partnership. In the weeks of his short illness, my father's brothers could not stay away. Uncle Dick came to my father's bedside again and again. He brought groceries and thick strip steaks from the butcher. My grandfather was a butcher, and the Aboud brothers knew and loved meat without apology. Before we grilled Uncle Dick's steaks, he cut off a corner just as my father would have and ate it with a slice of onion. The raw meat was not unlike the brothers in their approach to life. They must taste it raw to be sure it's genuinely good. Father's Day fell during the last week of my father's life. He was fighting the weakness caused by cancer, but still wanted to eat at the family table. He asked for Lebanese chicken and hashwi, a dish he knew would fill the house with the comforting scent of a buttery mixture of rice and toasted pine nuts. We sat together to eat, my three brothers, my sister, and me. My father came in on my mother's arm and sat at his place quietly. He looked over the table of steaming Sunday dinner and seemed to be recalling the history of meals placed before him just like this one. That long, narrow, cherry kitchen table and chairs made up the one set of furniture in our house that never underwent a major facelift. You can fit eight around the table when it's not in full leaf, and you don't much notice the chairs. Their role is simply to hold up the family and the food. Mom filled my father's plate with small portions of everything. He listened to us all talking and never did raise a fork to his mouth. After a short time, he needed to lie down. We shared his sorrow in leaving. He would not sit with us at the table again. Once he was settled on the couch, without speaking, we each took our plates into the family room and sat together, eating around him there.
That was Lansing native Maureen Abood remembering her father, Camille, who passed away right around Father's Day in 2000. A longer version of this essay appeared in the Washington Post in 2004. You can find more of Maureen's writing and recipes at maureenabood.com and also right here on Current State as our new occasional food contributor. This coming Sunday isn't just Father's Day, it's also National Fudge Day. By most accounts, the first batch of fudge was concocted in Baltimore in the 1880s. By the turn of the century, fudge making arrived on Mackinac Island in northern Michigan, which, as we hear from the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta, today has a legitimate claim as the modern-day fudge capital.
1. Tourists pile off ferries and onto Mackinac Island by the thousands every day during the summer. For many, one of the first stops when they arrive, or one of the last before they board a ferry back home, is one of the island's 15 or so fudge shops.
Which one do you like? You want the Rocky Road? Is that your favorite?
Janet Snyder is here with her daughter Madison, examining rows of different flavors.
I already bought peanut butter. So my husband's request to bring peanut butter fudge home because he couldn't come today.
But island-wide and here at Riba's Fudge Shop, the favorite is plain, unadulterated chocolate fudge. Meet Ed Turbin.
I'm the fudge maker at Riba's Fudge Shops. We start with the basic ingredients, the sugar and the corn syrup and the cream and the chocolate. And we blend those all together and mix them and cook them in the big copper kettle up to 232 degrees. When it gets to that temperature, we bring it out and we pour it here on the marble slabs into this frame.
After the mixture cools a bit, Ed Turbin goes to work, mixing, twisting, and flipping the fudge, lifting it into the air and slapping it down. It's a storefront operation. Tourists stop to watch through the window or they stroll into the store. Turbin says he's not just a fudge maker, he's a showman.
In fact, when no one's around for me to interact with, it's really a kind of a dull job for me just to make fudge. I mean, I know how to make fudge, but if I can do it for people and they come and they talk and they want to taste and, you know, they all ask the same questions, but they don't know that the last person asked the same question, so it's all new to them, so I treat every one of them like it's the first time.
So what are the questions?
Do you ever get it on the floor? Do your arms get tired? How long you been doing this?
Tell me that. So do you ever get it on the floor?
Never.
Do your arms get tired?
All the time. I'm tired right now.
And how long you been doing this?
For 31 years.
What's unique about Mackinac fudge is the way that it's made on the marble slabs, large batches at a time, in a very dramatic process.
Phil Porter is an island resident who wrote a short history of Mackinac's fudge business. He says candy has been a popular foodie souvenir here since Mackinac Island became a popular tourist destination in the late 1800s.
And one of the things that people did on vacation back then was that they liked to enjoy candy. Today we accept candy as an everyday phenomenon. Back then it was a treat. It was a treat that you did on vacation.
At first, the mainstay was maple syrup candy in little birch bark canoes. It was a cottage industry for nearby American Indian tribes. The candy shops expanded their sales over time to include taffy and peanut brittle. But Phil Porter says Mackinac's confectionery future was in fudge. By the 1920s, fudge shops lined the streets of Mackinac's downtown. Porter says electric fans pushed the smell into the streets, streets emptied of cars and trucks since they were banned in 1898.
And pretty soon people were like Pavlov's dogs. They had no choice but to go in and buy the fudge, and it's taken off since then.
The most common forms of transport on the island are bikes and horse-drawn carriages. On a hot summer day, the smell of fudge cooking wafts from the shops and combines with what the horses leave in the streets to make a visit to Mackinac a unique olfactory experience. For Current State, I'm Rick Pluta on Mackinac Island.
And Current State is always interested in hearing your feedback on the show, positive and otherwise. Today we thought we'd share a couple of recent comments regarding last week's interview with Aaron Payment, leader of Michigan's Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians, about a wolf hunt in Michigan. Monica Day had this online comment: "Today's interview was especially informative. I hope more media pick up the key points. Among those key points," she includes, "farmers already have laws to compensate them if livestock are taken by wolves, and, unlike deer, there is no population control justification." Also, Karen Beasley emailed us about Wednesday's interview with Robin Reynolds. Robin's the executive director of the Ingham Health Plan. Karen writes, "Listening to the show this morning, listeners were left with the idea that all counties have health plans. True enough, Karen, we failed to mention that. According to the Michigan Department of Community Health website, 10 of Michigan's 83 counties have no county health plan." Well, never hesitate to tell us what you think. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org, or you can get to us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState. And attention live music fans listening to Current State, for the past 5 years, the WKAR-TV show Backstage Pass has taken music from the Great Lakes region and showcased it on TV sets all across the country. Now is your chance to attend the filming of next year's Backstage Pass. This year's lineup includes acts like The Hard Lessons, Mustard Plug, Elliott Street Lunatic, and more. The performances will take place from Tuesday the 18th through Thursday, June 20th, at the East Lansing Hanna Center. Doors are open at 6:30, and admission is free. Now, tickets at the door for general seating are first come, first served, but you can also get your free tickets online, along with more information, at WKAR.org. Coming up next week on Current State, we will welcome a gubernatorial candidate you may not be aware of, Robin Sanders. That and more next week on Current State. We also noticed one thing from Craigslist, of all places, that we wanted to share with you. It appears that someone is searching for a closer for the Detroit Tigers. This appeared on Craigslist just the last few days. "We are looking for a new closing pitcher to replace Papa Grande. While we're not certain that we can find a qualified major league pitcher on Craigslist, we also feel that anyone that happens to respond is likely to be more qualified than our current position holder." Ouch. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joel Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Emmanuel Berry and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.